Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Impact of influence, the Murdoch family murders. This is the unfolding story of a powerful South Carolina family, the mysterious deaths they are linked to, and our quest to bring you the truth.
Hello, friend. I am Matt Harris. Seton Tucker is here. We are rolling right along with your help. So thank you. Grateful that you always listen and hang with us. And watch now that we're putting some vids up on the Impact of Influence YouTube channel. Look for a link in on our Facebook page, Impact of Influence. We are dealing with Murdoch and other cases now, but still a lot of Alec Murdoch left. And last week, we did a deep dive into the financial crime sentencing that Seton, you were there, and played some clips for you. And one of the people who was there was a friend of the pod and a guy who's very involved in, he's at the Murdoch trial, the murder trial every day. And he's been on Court TV with me and on his own. And he is a professor and an attorney in Columbia, South Carolina, and represents two of the jurors involved in the jury tampering case with the Becky Hill clerk of courts and the Alec Murdoch trial. We welcome Joe McCullough, who has been near this case the entire time, the whole Murdoch mess. He's been on Court TV a ton of times. I'm sure you'd recognize him, and I've been on there with him. He also represents a couple of the jurors. We'll get into that in a little bit. But Joe, you and Seton were there for the sentencing, and I want some of your initial oversight thoughts on the event, if you will.
Well, I have lots of thoughts. I was first, let me say that it was 5 hours of being held hostage, though I can't think of a better person to be a hostage of the Murdochs with Seton. That softened the blow.
It was long. I wasn't expecting it to be that long.
Well, it was long for several reasons, and I suspect, I mean, this is a negotiated plea, and I think I've explained before that in the world of criminal law, there are three kinds of pleas. There are straight-up pleas where you walk into court and the judge is aware of what the maximum and minimum sentences are, and the judge does whatever the heck he wants to do to the defendant after presentations by the prosecution and defense. Straight up. There is a recommendation or a recommended plea in which the prosecution recommends a sentence that the judge can follow or disregard, generally endorsed, but sometime opposed by the defendant's lawyers. And then there is the kind of plea that we walked into court the other day at 10 o'clock and emerged at 4 o'clock or thereabouts. And that was a negotiated plea. And a negotiated plea is a unique animal that some judges in our state will not accept. They simply will say, I don't like that sentence. I think it's too light. I think it's too heavy. And because a negotiated plea is a plea that imposes upon the judge to either accept it and take the plea or reject it and send the parties on their way to find another judge, there was a little bit of suspense that Cliff Newman might regard this sentence as too light. But he didn't disappoint anybody, and he went forward. But what took 5 hours in a negotiated plea that could have been done in 30 minutes, I think you can attribute to the fact that the state took, by my clock, 2 hours of extemporaneous speaking, apparently extemporaneous, when in reality, I think that they had written their openings and closings for this trial that until a week out was to be a trial. And because they'd spent all that quality time writing down their speech, I think they just had to deliver their speech. Because why waste a good written opening and closing speech? But I think that verbosity, infected Alec Murdoch. And when he had the chance to say something, and he obviously had a plan and had goals that included the most insincere apologies of all time, but also allowed him to again and again and again in his 1 hour of speech to deny again that and claim his innocence of the murders. And you know, who knows, he may be, but a jury didn't believe that. But I think he was infected by the length of the state's presentation and felt quite that you know, the rest of the afternoon was equally available to him, and he took a fair amount of it. So
I did not know he spoke for an hour.
No, he did. And at the beginning, they said, "Oh, he's going to talk for 5 minutes," and then they said, "Well, maybe 10." And then it was, I think I timed it. I think it was 40 something minutes.
Like, oh yeah, a lot. Well, and I think Creighton's speech was the same.
This was an hour.
His was like the same one he gave at the actual sentencing a week ago.
Correct. I mean, it was a redundant thing, and I really think it's just it's a product of two things. Number one, I think the speech had been written, and why waste a good speech, as I said. But I also think that when you put a bunch of televisions in a courtroom and a bunch of media, you know, it's his boss gets reelected. Apparently his boss is running for governor. I suspect this whole trial process will figure in some advertising campaigns in the next election cycle. But I think that the cameras create that problem. They impose upon people to profile and high step around the courtroom in ways that they might not do. And it certainly is less than that judicial economy that we all strive to achieve in these presentations. But instead of
being about the victims, the cameras there, everybody needs to have their time in the spotlight.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that's the problem, is when the lights go on, you're not getting a tan, you're getting public exposure.
Dick didn't want the lawyers to speak, right? Dick was kind of going for Dick Harpootlian was asked Judge Newman just to have the victim speak, correct?
Matt, he did. He rose right before the state began, or maybe it was at the end of, and by my clock, Creighton's presentation to the court lasted 1 hour and a half. And after
that's longer than I thought.
After he presented the victims and their lawyers, Bland and Tinsley and Bamberg, which took another hour, he then spoke for another 30 minutes. And then turned it over to Harpootlian. But before the victims started, Dick Harpootlian got up and in maybe the only humorous light moment of the day, said that he objected to talking or speaking, because of course they're always entitled to do that. But he objected to the redundancy of the victims and then their lawyers. And he said, you know, there are some lawyers in the courtroom who are here for infomercial purposes, who are selling T-shirts and bobbleheads. And of course, everybody in the courtroom knew exactly who that was a reference to. And if there was any question about who Dick was referring to, I think Ronnie Richter, Eric Bland's partner, made it pretty clear when he got up to defend his law partner, weirdly, about selling bobbleheads and T-shirts, which he confirmed and said, but we're giving it all to charity. And I don't know where the revenue from the podcast Cuff of Jazz comes from, but Eric made he's quite the promoter, and he mentioned in his speech, by my little hash marks, I think he mentioned his Cuff of Jazz five times.
His podcast,
in his 30-minute, it's Cup of Justice, but I call it Cup of Jazz.
Well, he also brought up that the defense team has their own podcast. Jim Griffin is in a podcast with Sarah Azari, The Presumption. So he kind of, and when Eric Bland talked about it, he shot back at him.
Well, he did. And I mean, those were all diversions. They were absolutely unnecessary in a negotiated plea. And I guess that's the real point here. A negotiated plea, everything is carved in stone. The Ten Commandments have been carved in that stone and presented to the judge and he's going to accept it or reject it. It was pretty clear he was accepting it. So we didn't need to hear from anybody really, other than the victims, to give them that time that they needed, to the extent that a sentencing and the veredicto moment that occurs when a guilty verdict occurs or a jury verdict occurs, no matter what it is, that in theory gives the victims finality and some sense of satisfaction. I said, I think on Court TV the other night that I've never been in a courtroom where I saw more people wishing for Alec Murdoch to burst into flames because he just did not satisfy anyone with his apologies and his narcissism.
Oh, yes. I mean, I can't count the amount of times he said, I or me.
Well, unfortunately, a lot of the presentations were all about me. Certainly, Alec Murdoch's was a very specific goals, which were made clear over that 45-minute to an hour, and were not satisfying and didn't accomplish a damn thing. Accomplished less, I suspect, than he accomplished in his testimony during the trial. He didn't persuade anybody in the trial, and he certainly did not persuade anybody in that courtroom the other day.
He still thinks he has the magic. He still thinks he has the magic elixir. It's still, he thinks that he can still BS his way out of things.
Well, I think we know that magic has gone. It has dissipated, but maybe he'll have magic in cell block number whatever when he hits the Department of Corrections.
What I also thought was really odd about his addressing the victims is he only addressed the victims for, I think, the first little part of it, and then he moved on to apologizing to everybody else in his life, which that wasn't really what we were there for. Why didn't he write them a letter?
Well, I don't know. I thought the weirdest moment of his presentation was to his thanking the addiction treatment facility for their excellent work with him.
That was really odd. And like, I get it. I saw someone on social media say something about, you know, it's a good thing to bring awareness to, you know, that's obviously a terrible problem in our country. I get that. But it was also, it appeared to be like an infomercial for this treatment center.
He specifically named the place.
Named the detox and the second place that he went to. So it was bizarre.
Yeah.
Well, addiction, I think he brought that up, Seton, to try and again sell to the public that all this missing money went down his gullet in the form of opioids. And I don't think anybody on the planet believes that any human can eat that many pills and make that much money disappear. And so that really was kind of ridiculous. But I want to mention that Judge Newman was more restrained than I expected and appeared to me to be almost relieved, as he said, he was closing the page on this, but it was not closing for Murdoch. But I thought the most important thing, observation he made, was I tried to reach you at the end of the murder trial. He said something on that order, and he said, but I found you then, and today I find you to be empty. Mm. And I thought that was an excellent description of Alec Murdoch in that courtroom. He was empty of soul.
What did you think about Judge Newman comparing him to a man who shot a police officer and then burned him? He said, you are a person who is almost just as bad.
Well, I think that was exactly the moment when he described, he said, he referred to that murderer and torturer as a person who was empty, really devoid of empathy and I call it soul. And that was the analogy that he made. What do I think about that? I don't know that he was equating the crimes, may have been, but I thought that he was, explaining this empty
vessel.
Empty reference. Yeah. That, and that was a way to give it, a more complete context. So that was, you know, I expected to hear a bit more from him, and but I thought his remarks were appropriate, and it, and finally we got the sentence and got to leave. But it was quite. The entire process was what I'll call wretched excess, just lots of gilding the lily and giving lawyers primarily the opportunity to say what they've said countless times before. And it was the victim's only chance to speak. And, you know, I hope it was somewhat satisfying for the victims.
Let's talk about one of our sponsors. It is Factor. You can eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals.
Every fresh meal is never frozen and is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, and they are ready in just 2 minutes.
Where did you have chili the other day?
Delicious.
And if you want gourmet meals, you can try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, asparagus. So head to factormeals.com/impact50 and use code impact50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box.
That code's impact50 at factormeals.com/impact50 to get 50% off your first box and 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Impact 50 at factormeals.com/impact50 to get 50% off your first box and 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
True terrors of horror, bizarre happenings, unexplainable events. On our podcast, Disturbed, terror takes center stage. Each episode is a journey into the darkest corners of human existence, delving into bone-chilling tales of kidnappings, serial killers, maniacs, and the very essence of your worst nightmares coming to life on this weekly true horror show. Disturbed is not for the faint of heart. It's an exploration of real, unadulterated horror sourced from everyday people. Each episode is a descent into the macabre, where we narrate stories that will leave you on the edge of your seat and crawling in your skin. We navigate the disturbing narratives that lurk in the shadows, offering a raw and unfiltered listen into the most terrifying aspects of the human experience. Enter at your own risk and let the unsettling tales unfold in the haunting realm of Disturbed. And remember, listeners, stay safe out there.
Ohio is a land of mystery. From missing shipwrecks and lost treasure beneath her surface to strange phenomena slicing through her skies. From myths that have evolved around historic events and people to the unsolved murders and disappearances that keep her communities wondering what happened. Find Ohio Mysteries on your favorite podcast app and let's explore the inexplicable. OhioMysteries.com.
I want to talk about the victims in a moment, but I wanted to ask you first, backtrack to what we were talking about, these missing funds, and there was some references to narcotics and that sort of thing. I, as just a member of the general public, podcaster, was thinking that we were going to get some more answers about all this missing money. What is your take on that?
I haven't seen the agreement between the state and Alec Murdoch. Typically, his agreement to cooperate with the federal authorities would require a polygraph. I'd be interested in seeing the polygraph chart on if the question is asked, is all the money gone or is it somewhere hidden? That'd be a swell question to ask. You wouldn't ask it exactly like that. But I mean, I just don't believe that it's possible for that explanation to be accurate, that all of the money went down a drug hole. I just don't believe that.
Well, people always talk about the stolen money, which is maybe $10 million or more, But people forget that he was also drawing a pretty good salary at the time, too.
And Fitz had an article this week that referenced that possibly some of this money, they're looking into offshore accounts.
Well, that's been rumored forever, right?
Yeah.
He owns enough property to be buried in one of these, you know, those non-habitable islands that you have around down there.
Well, you know, Matt, I've been in, I have communications from a woman in another state, I'll just say, who communicates with me, and she speaks with the dead, and she advised me several months ago that she was being told by the beyond that the monies were hidden in coffins in a cemetery in another state, that Alec Murdoch financed an interest in this funeral home and cemetery.
Sounds Ozarky.
It does.
Yeah.
It does sound Ozarky, but, you know, stranger things have happened.
Sure.
Who the hell knows where the money is? I believe it's out there somewhere. I just don't know that we will ever find it.
Let's move to, while we have you, to the jury tampering situation, the charges. Are you representing one jurors?
Two and a half jurors. I had conversations with three, but I'm currently representing two of the jurors.
The AG's office, when they sent their response to Harpootlian and Griffin,
motion for a new trial.
Yeah, well, motion for the new trial.
Their response to the court.
To the court. One of the things in there, and I will not give you the wording exactly, but it mentions you and you not allowing your clients to be interviewed by SLED, the State Law Enforcement Division, in their early investigation, quotey fingers. And I understand you had a response to that, and did you write them a letter? Did you call them? How did that play out?
Well, maybe the day following the Court of Appeals granting of a stay of the appeal and remanding the matter back to the trial judge at that time, Cliff Newman, which was granting the relief that the defense requested. You had to get it out of the appellate status so that there could be a motion for a new trial. And so in the what that did is, once the Court of Appeals granted that remand to the trial level, the Attorney General's office felt that they needed to make a response. Technically, they really didn't. But the day after that remand occurred, I began to receive phone calls from a very nice SLED agent who said they'd like to talk with my clients. And I said, you know, I'm happy to make them available at some point, but I'm not sure that I want to do that several times. I don't want to inconvenience these people. It's just antithetical to people out there in the public who are called upon to be jurors to know that they're going to have to be involved in this kind of stuff and maybe interviewed multiple times. So let's wait until we get a judge. And based on what I understand is occurring now, I don't believe Judge Newman is going to be the judge. And so I think we need to hold off on an interview, but I'm telling you, SLED agent, they will cooperate and speak with whoever ultimately is directed to conduct an investigation. And I said then, and several days later, I received a call from Creighton Waters, the chief prosecutor. And I said the same thing to him, that they were absolutely willing to cooperate in an investigation. They were willing to be interviewed, that I would be present, that I might have some boundaries, but I wanted those conversations recorded and memorialized. But I wasn't certain that the Attorney General's office, which I feel has a conflict of interest, they have a guilty verdict to protect, and I'm not sure they can be completely objective in an investigation. I'm not sure that SLED, who achieved was the investigating agency in the murder case, I'm not certain that they can be objective. And I explained all that to the SLED agent and to Creighton Waters. And then in their response, Matt, which gets back to your question, they said that I was being uncooperative.
Right.
Well, that was not exactly true. All I said was, in the letter, which I'm happy to make available to anybody who would like it, I said, let's wait until the judge is appointed and until the dust settles and we know who the investigating agency is going to be and we know who the supervising prosecuting agency is going to be, and let them ask me for the interviews so that I only have to do this one time. I'm not concerned about my time as much as my client's time. They both spent 6 weeks in a courtroom for $10 a day in the most grueling and visually obscene trial I can imagine. And now they're going to have to be interviewed to determine if a fair trial occurred or if there was improper interference with the jury's deliberations that rise to the point of materiality that requires a new trial. These are the most important issues we deal with in jury trials, and I don't want them to have to be interviewed multiple times.
What are your thoughts on this evidentiary hearing that's been requested? Do you think that that's the right time for them to be interviewed?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, we don't have a lot of case law. There is no statutory process set out in law. But our cases, the few that there are about improper jury interference, dictate that the judge who is ultimately assigned by the Supreme Court to hear this, and we don't yet have a judge assigned, if the judge follows precedent in these very few cases, one is State v. Green, the time-honored method is to bring the entire jury panel and the alternates back, which would include the juror I represent who was excused minutes before the jury was to begin deliberations, and they would then be brought into the court one at a time, I suspect in camera, meaning there won't be any cameras, there won't be any public, and the judge would conduct the inquiry, receiving questions from the lawyers, but the lawyers would not be allowed to interrogate these jurors. And they'll come in one at a time and they'll be asked a series of questions by the judge with questions provided by the lawyers that the judge determines are pertinent and that the judge is willing to ask. And at the end of all of these jurors, then I think the judge has to make a determination of whether there was interference, whether that interference was material in the sense that did it likely impact the jury in a way that interfered with their independent, objective deliberations. And if so, it's pretty clear that the judge has the duty of ordering a new trial. And that will be a big deal. It will be a big deal for Alec Murdoch, because it means that the guilty verdict would evaporate and then the Attorney General's office would be challenged to retry the case. And they've said pretty pointedly at the end of this process, at the end of the other day's sentencing hearing, that if somehow this motion for new trial resulted in a new trial, that he would be retried. Well, I'm not so sure about all that, but it seemed to me that throughout the proceedings the other day that the prosecution was pretty defensive about this possibility of a new trial and equally defensive about the term of years, whether it was enough of a sentence. And I think several of the jurors probably requested to do so, endorsed the 27 years as sufficient for their minds. Mr. Tinsley, in a kind of a backhanded way, Seton, you may remember, did not endorse the sentence. I think it was his personal opinion, though he didn't specifically say it, but he kind of, in a backhanded way, suggested that he didn't believe that was a sufficient sentence for Alec Murdoch.
But I thought Creighton Waters did a great job saying, look, this is more time than people in the Enron scandal got. Like, this is 27 years, most likely the rest of his life. And that he said, I challenge anybody to find a white collar crime defendant who has gotten more time than Alec Murdoch has.
Yeah.
Well, That may be true. I haven't searched the annals.
I don't know either, but that's well, what he said.
I know a bunch of, because I've been involved in cases where people get multiple life sentences, and as Alec Murdoch did in the murder trial, decades upon decades that far exceed the ability of a human to serve the sentence. And I recall vividly one of our old judges in the old days when I was a young lawyer who sentenced a fella to 120 years, and the defendant said, "Well, judge, I ain't gonna live that long. I can't do all that time." And the judge said, "Well, you know, do the best you can." And then he walked out.
Do the best you can.
I just want to end with a quick question. I'm not sure. I also know that you had, I believe, you have a motion to redact, right? You had an issue with, in the state's response, I believe not all the names were redacted, all the jurors' names were redacted.
That is correct. And one of the things that our courts are pretty strict about is in any filing, you are required to redact, that is to black out, I guess is a better way to say it, strike out any personally identifiable information, especially things like birth dates, phone numbers, social security numbers. But everybody had been careful in this case because Judge Newman directed at the beginning of the trial that there would not be any photographs of the jury members. They would not be identified by anything except juror numbers.
Not where they worked, nothing like that. Yeah.
And I seem to recall that some of our journalists within a week of the jury selection were sanctioned by the judge mm-hmm. by excommunicating them from attendance because they released a spreadsheet of where jurors worked. I don't think they mentioned their names, but I think they mentioned the exact names of the places that they worked, which was basically outing them for the public's consumption. And that put pressure that the judge had really intended to avoid. So going back to what I, in my letter to Mr. Waters, saying that I wanted to accomplish three things. I wanted to explain, one, that I was not happy that one of my clients, one of these jurors, were identified by first name in several failed redactions. That was corrected the day after my letter was received. So there was and I filed a motion to that effect with Judge Newman, which became moot when it was fixed. The second thing I wanted to accomplish was to reassure Mr. Waters and Sled that my folks, and the court for that matter, because I copied the judge on the letter, that they will cooperate. They will testify under oath. Most of the jurors, well, in fact, none of the jurors that were featured in the response by Creighton Waters gave anything but unsworn statements. Not one juror, as I recall, gave information and made statements that were sworn under oath. The only person who did that was the clerk of court, which I found curious, but really? Be that as it may, the other thing I wanted to achieve is to make sure that Creighton understood and that the Alan Wilson understand that my decision at this point not to make them available to Sled and to the AG's office is that they may not be involved in this inquiry. And so to avoid doing this multiple times and to avoid the possibility that they might not be wholly objective in their investigation, let's wait for a judge to tell me who we need to appear before, and we'll be there. And we'll be, again, willing to raise our hand, swear on a Bible, and tell the same truth that is embodied in the affidavits that were filed, given to the defense and filed as a part of the defense motion for new trial.
Oh, and one thing else you wanted to accomplish was they kind of took a jab at your client as being dishonest or something, which Seton and I remember when they let her go. The judge was very complimentary to her.
He was. He said she was, from all things, seen, she was an exemplary juror.
Yeah.
Well, he said that she had not done anything wrong, and her removal was not because she had done anything wrong. And I thought it was interesting, and I pointed that out in my letter as well. Thanks for reminding me, Matt, because that really figured prominently in my letter, that I thought that, you know, shame on the Attorney General for doing exactly what he observed in his own response to the motion, where he said that jury duty is such a burden that we should do nothing that would discourage people to participate as jurors. And I said in the letter, I can't think of anything more discouraging to a juror than to be branded dishonest by the Attorney General's office. And why in the hell you'd do that without ever speaking to them? Well, it should not be lost on anyone who is listening to this program. Even in the response filed by the Attorney General's office and these unsworn statements of the jurors, at least two of the jurors indicated that there were communications from court officials. I don't recall that they identified whether it was clerk of court or who, that they were told to observe the demeanor of the defense witnesses.
Yeah, body language.
Body language. And you know, that confirms and corroborates exactly what my client said occurred. And these, you know, these proceedings will be very interesting. But I suspect that the initial process will occur in camera, not on court TV.
What is your opinion of these jurors, which is in the state's own filing, saying observe body language and demeanor? Is that enough to get a new trial?
No. But I think that you will certainly can anticipate that those jurors who I think were identified by numbers, by jury number, that when the defense and when the judge conducts his or her inquiry, that they'll be asking more about that.
Right. They can dig deeper.
When did that occur?
Yeah.
When did that occur? And was that, you know, if the statement was made to jurors, and at least two of them in the response by the state, and of course the two jurors I represent under oath have said that it went much further than that, but included watch the body language. But my clients indicate in their affidavits that those references to watch the body language and to be skeptical about were references only to Alec Murdoch and defense witnesses. And so if those references, these two jurors mentioned by the Attorney General's response, were only told to watch the body language of the defense witnesses, that's a tell. That's not good. And that gets you closer to that problem of materiality and improper influence.
Joey, we'll have you back. I will. We'll put your letter up on our Facebook page. If that's cool with you.
That's good.
All right, brother. Thank you. Talk soon, Joe.
You bet.
Bye.
See you.
Thank you. Bye. Always a pleasure to talk to Joe McCullough. He is just such a character.
Interesting guy and smart guy, and we will have him on again. That is for sure. And I'm sure you will have some reaction. And you can send it to us via the Impact of Influence Facebook page and a YouTube channel. Impact of Influence is getting up and running, so check that out. Thank you, Evergreen Podcast Company. We're part of the Evergreen Podcast family now. We thank them. And Seton, we will talk soon, friend.
Are you interested in the world's most dangerous cults?
I left Scientology.
Scientology. Scientology.
Scientology can help you with that.
Phone calls are all listened to. I couldn't do or say anything.
Tom Cruise is a monster.
Join me on the Edge with Andrew Gold, that's the name of the podcast, as I interview defectors and members of cults from Scientology and Nixium to the extreme ends of Mormons, Jehovah's Witnesses, and Hasidic Jews.
Children are murdered for money.
Insanely intense about sex.
I mean, what kind of a god? He sounds like a pimp.
I'll talk to psychopaths.
I'm only talking to you because I want something out of it.
And celebrities like biologist Richard Dawkins. They took away this Humanist of the Year award.
I'd like to say it's their loss, not mine.
Singer Robbie Williams and murder suspect Amanda Knox. That's On the Edge with Andrew Gold, wherever you get your podcasts.
From DNA testing to the Dixie Mafia, Crime Capsule brings you new stories of true crime in American history. I'm your host, Benjamin Morris. Join us for exclusive interviews with authors from Arcadia Publishing, writing the hottest books on the most chilling stories of our country's past. You can find us wherever you get your favorite podcasts or on evergreenpodcasts.com. Crime Capsule, history so interesting, it's criminal.